Section 1 of my inventions and other works, the autobiography of Nikola Tesla, electrical experimenter, February to October 1919. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Kane Mercer. My Inventions, Part 1, My Early Life, by Nikola Tesla. This article was published in Electrical Experimenter, February 1919. How does the world's greatest inventor invent? How does he carry out an invention? What sort of mentality has Nikola Tesla? Was his early life as commonplace as most of ours? What was the early training of one of the world's chosen? These and many other very interesting questions are answered in an incomparable manner by Nikola Tesla himself in this, his first article. In his autobiography, treating mainly on his early youth, we obtain a good insight into the wonderful life this man has led. It reads like a fairy tale, which has the advantage of being true, for Tesla is no common mortal. He has led a charmed life, struck down by the pest, the cholera, and whatnot, given up by doctors at least 3 times as dead. We find him at 60, younger than ever. But, read his own words, you have never read the like before. Editor. The progressive development of man is vitally dependent on invention. It is the most important product of his creative brain. Its ultimate purpose is the complete mastery of mind over the material world, the harnessing of the forces of nature to human needs. This is the difficult task of the inventor, who is often misunderstood and unrewarded. But he finds ample compensation in the pleasing exercises of his powers, and in the knowledge of being one of that exceptionally privileged class without whom the race would have long ago perished in the bitter struggle against pitiless elements. Speaking for myself, I have already had more than my full measure of this exquisite enjoyment, so much that for many years my life was little short of continuous rapture. I am credited with being one of the hardest workers, and perhaps I am, if thought is the equivalent of labor, for I have devoted to it almost all of my waking hours. But if work is interpreted to be a definite performance in a specified time according to a rigid rule, then I may be the worst of idlers. Every effort under compulsion demands a sacrifice of life energy. I never paid such a price. On the contrary, I have thrived on my thoughts. In attempting to give a connected and faithful account of my activities in this series of articles, which will be presented with the assistance of the editors of the Electrical Experimenter and are chiefly addressed to our young men readers, I must dwell, however reluctantly, on the impressions of my youth and the circumstances and events which have been instrumental in determining my career. Our first endeavors are purely instinctive, promptings of an imagination vivid and undisciplined. As we grow older, reason asserts itself and we become more and more systematic and designing. But those early impulses, though not immediately productive, are of the greatest moment and may shape our very destinies. Indeed, I feel now that had I understood and cultivated instead of suppressing them, I would have added substantial value to my bequest to the world. But not until I had attained manhood did I realize that I was an inventor. This was due to a number of causes. In the first place, I had a brother who was gifted to an extraordinary degree, one of those rare phenomena of mentality which biological investigation has failed to explain.
His premature death left my parents disconsolate.
We owned a horse, which had been presented to us by a dear friend. It was a magnificent animal of Arabian breed, possessed of almost human intelligence, and was cared for and petted by the whole family, having on one occasion saved my father's life under remarkable circumstances.
My father had been called one winter night to perform an urgent duty, and while crossing the mountains infested by wolves, the horse became frightened and ran away, throwing him violently to the ground. It arrived home bleeding and exhausted, but after the alarm was sounded, immediately dashed off again, returning to the spot, and before the searching party were far on the way, they were met by my father, who had recovered consciousness and remounted, not realizing that he had been lying in the snow for several hours.
This horse was responsible for my brother's injuries, from which he died. I witnessed the tragic scene, and although 56 years have elapsed since, my visual impression of it has lost none of its force. The recollection of his attainments made every effort of mine seem dull in comparison. Anything I did that was creditable merely caused my parents to feel their loss more keenly. So I grew up with little confidence in myself.
But I was far from being considered a stupid boy, if I am to judge from an incident of which I have still a strong remembrance.
One day, the aldermen were passing through a street where I was at play with other boys. The oldest of these venerable gentlemen, a wealthy citizen, paused to give a silver piece to each of us. Coming to me, he suddenly stopped and commanded, "Look in my eyes." I met his gaze, my hand outstretched to receive the much-valued coin, when to my dismay he said, "No, not much. You can get nothing from me, you are too smart." They used to tell a funny story about me. I had two old aunts with wrinkled faces, one of them having two teeth protruding like tusks of an elephant, which she buried in my cheek every time she kissed me. Nothing would scare me more than the prospect of being hugged by these affectionate as unattractive relatives. It happened that while being carried in my mother's arms, they asked me who was the prettier of the two. After examining their faces intently, I answered thoughtfully, pointing to one of them, "This here is not as ugly as the other." Then again, I was intended from my very birth for the clerical profession, and this thought constantly oppressed me. I longed to be an engineer, but my father was inflexible. He was the son of an officer who served in the army of the great Napoleon, and, in common with his brother, professor of mathematics in a prominent institution, had received a military education but, singularly enough, later embraced the clergy, in which vocation he achieved eminence.
He was a very erudite man, a veritable natural philosopher, poet, and writer, and his sermons were said to be as eloquent as those of Abraham Santa Clara.
He had a prodigious memory, and frequently recited at length from works in several languages. He often remarked playfully that if some of the classics were lost, he could restore them. His style of writing was much admired. He penned sentences short and terse, and was full of wit and satire. The humorous remarks he made were always peculiar and characteristic. Just to illustrate, I may mention one or two instances. Among the help, there was a cross-eyed man called Maine, employed to do work around the farm. He was chopping wood one day. As he swung the axe, my father, who stood nearby and felt very uncomfortable, cautioned him. "For God's sake, Maine, do not strike at what you are looking, but at what you intend to hit." On another occasion, he was taking out for a drive a friend who carelessly permitted his costly fur coat to rub on the carriage wheel. My father reminded him of it, saying, "Pull in your coat, you are ruining my tire."
He had the odd habit of talking to himself and would often carry on an animated conversation and indulge in heated argument, changing the tone of his voice. A casual listener might have sworn that several people were in the same room. Although I must trace to my mother's influence whatever inventiveness I possess, the training he gave me must have been helpful. It comprised all sorts of exercises as guessing one another's thoughts, discovering the defects of some form or expression, repeating long sentences, or performing mental calculations.
These daily lessons were intended to strengthen memory and reason and especially to develop the critical sense, and were undoubtedly very beneficial. My mother descended from one of the oldest families in the country and a line of inventors.
Both her father and grandfather originated numerous implements for household, agricultural, and other uses.
She was a truly great woman of rare skill, courage, and fortitude, who had braved the storms of life and passed through many a trying experience. When she was 16, a virulent pestilence swept the country. Her father was called away to administer the last sacraments to the dying, and during his absence, she went alone to the assistance of a neighboring family who were stricken by the dread disease. All of the members, five in number, succumbed in rapid succession.
She bathed, clothed, and laid out the bodies, decorating them with flowers according to the custom of the country, and when her father returned, he found everything ready for a Christian burial. My mother was an inventor of the first order, and would, I believe, have achieved great things had she not been so remote from modern life and its multifold opportunities.
She invented and constructed all kinds of tools and devices, and wove the finest designs from thread which was spun by her. She even planted the seeds, raised the plants, and separated the fibers herself. She worked indefatigably from break of day till late at night, and most of the wearing apparel and furnishings of the home was the product of her hands. When she was past 60, her fingers were still nimble enough to tie 3 knots in an eyelash.
There was another and still more important reason for my late awakening. In my boyhood, I suffered from a peculiar affliction due to the appearance of images, often accompanied by strong flashes of light, which marred the sight of real objects and interfered with my thought and action.
They were pictures of things and scenes which I had already seen, never of those I imagined. When a word was spoken to me, the image of the object it designated would present itself vividly to my vision, and sometimes I was quite unable to distinguish whether what I saw was tangible or not. This caused me great discomfort and anxiety. None of the students of psychology or physiology whom I have consulted could ever explain satisfactorily these phenomena. They seem to have been unique, although I was probably predisposed, as I know my brother experienced a similar trouble. The theory I have formulated is that the images were the result of a reflex action from the brain on the retina under great excitation.
They certainly were not hallucinations such as are produced in diseased and anguished minds, for in other respects I was normal and composed. To give an idea of my distress, suppose that I had witnessed a funeral or some such nerve-wracking spectacle.
Then, inevitably, in the stillness of night, a vivid picture of the scene would thrust itself before my eyes and persist despite all my efforts to banish it. Sometimes it would even remain fixed in space, though I pushed my hand through it.
If my explanation is correct, it should be able to project on a screen the image of any object one conceives and make it visible. Such an advance would revolutionize all human relations. I'm convinced that this wonder can and will be accomplished in time to come.
I may add that I have devoted much thought to the solution of the problem. To free myself of these tormenting appearances, I tried to concentrate my mind on something else I had seen, and in this way I would often obtain temporary relief, but in order to get it I had to conjure continuously new images.
It was not long before I found that I had exhausted all of those at my command. My reel had run out, as it were, because I had seen little of the world, only objects in my home and the immediate surroundings.
As I performed these mental operations for the second or third time, in order to chase the appearances from my vision, the remedy gradually lost all its force. Then I instinctively commenced to make excursions beyond the limits of the small world of which I had knowledge, and I saw new scenes. These were at first very blurred and indistinct, and would flit away when I tried to concentrate my attention upon them, but by and by I succeeded in fixing them. They gained in strength and distinctness, and finally assumed the correctness of real things. I soon discovered that my best comfort was attained if I simply went on in my vision farther and farther, getting new impressions all the time. And so I began to travel, of course, in my mind. Every night, and sometimes during the day, when alone, I would start on my journeys, see new places, cities and countries, live there, meet people, and make friendships and acquaintances, and, however unbelievable, It is a fact that they were just as dear to me as those in actual life, and not a bit less intense in their manifestations. This I did constantly until I was about 17, when my thoughts turned seriously to invention.
Then I observed to my delight that I could visualize with the greatest facility. I needed no models, drawings, or experiments. I could picture them all as real in my mind.
Thus I have been led unconsciously to evolve what I consider a new method of materializing inventive concepts and ideas, which is radically opposite to the purely experimental and is, in my opinion, ever so much more expeditious and efficient. The moment one constructs a device to carry into practice a crude idea, he finds himself unavoidably engrossed with the details and defects of the apparatus.
As he goes on improving and reconstructing, his force of concentration diminishes and he loses sight of the great underlying principle. Results may be obtained, but always at the sacrifice of quality.
My method is different. I do not rush into actual work. When I get an idea, I start at once building it up in my imagination. I change the construction, make improvements, and operate the device in my mind. It is absolutely immaterial to me whether I run my turbine in thought or test it in my shop. I even note if it is out of balance. There is no difference whatsoever. The results are the same. In this way, I am able to rapidly develop and perfect a conception without touching anything. When I have gone so far as to embody in the invention every possible improvement I can think of and see no fault anywhere, I put into concrete form this final product of my brain. Invariably, my device works as I conceived that it should, and the experiment comes out exactly as I planned it. In 20 years, there has not been a single exception. Why should it be otherwise? Engineering, electrical and mechanical, is positive in results. There is scarcely a subject that cannot be mathematically treated, and the effects calculated or the results determined beforehand from the available theoretical and practical data. The carrying out into practice of a crude idea, as is being generally done, is, I hold, nothing but a waste of energy, money, and time. My early affliction had, however, another compensation. The incessant mental exertion developed my powers of observation and enabled me to discover a truth of great importance.
I had noted that the appearance of images was always preceded by the actual vision of scenes under peculiar and generally very exceptional conditions, and I was impelled on each occasion to locate the original impulse. After a while, this effort grew to be almost automatic, and I gained great facility in connecting cause and effect.
Soon I became aware, to my surprise, that every thought I conceived was suggested by an external impression. Not only this, but all my actions were prompted in a similar way. In the course of time, it became perfectly evident to me that I was merely an automaton, endowed with power of movement, responding to the stimuli of the sense organs, and thinking and acting accordingly.
The practical result of this was the art of telautomatics, which has been so far carried out only in an imperfect manner. Its latent possibilities will, however, be eventually shown. I have been since years planning self-controlled automata and believe that mechanisms can be produced which will act as if possessed of reason to a limited degree and will create a revolution in many commercial and industrial departments. I was about 12 years old when I first succeeded in banishing an image from my vision by willful effort, but I never had any control over the flashes of light to which I have referred.
They were, perhaps, my strangest experience and inexplicable. They usually occurred when I found myself in a dangerous or distressing situation, or when I was greatly exhilarated. In some instances, I have seen all the air around me filled with tongues of living flame. Their intensity, instead of diminishing, increased with time and seemingly attained a maximum when I was about 25 years old. While in Paris, in 1883, a prominent French manufacturer sent me an invitation to a shooting expedition, which I accepted. I had been long confined to the factory, and the fresh air had a wonderfully invigorating effect on me. On my return to the city that night, I felt a positive sensation that my brain had caught fire. I saw a light as though a small sun was located in it, and I passed the whole night applying cold compressions to my tortured head. Finally, the flashes diminished in frequency and force, but it took me more than 3 weeks before they wholly subsided. When a second invitation was extended to me, my answer was an emphatic no. These luminous phenomena still manifest themselves from time to time, as when a new idea opening up possibilities strikes me. But they are no longer exciting, being of relatively small intensity. When I close my eyes, I invariably observe first a background of very dark and uniform blue, not unlike the sky on a clear but starless night.
In a few seconds, this field becomes animated with innumerable scintillating flakes of green, arranged in several layers and advancing towards me.
Then there appears, to the right, a beautiful pattern of two systems of parallel and closely spaced lines at right angles to one another, in all sorts of colors with yellow-green and gold predominating. Immediately thereafter, the lines grow brighter, and the whole is thickly sprinkled with dots of twinkling light. This picture moves slowly across the field of vision, and in about 10 seconds vanishes to the left, leaving behind a ground of rather unpleasant and inert gray, which quickly gives way to a billowy sea of clouds, seemingly trying to mold themselves in living shapes. It is curious that I cannot project a form into this gray until the second phase is reached. Every time before falling asleep, images of persons or objects flit before my view. When I see them, I know that I am about to lose consciousness. If they are absent and refuse to come, it means a sleepless night.
To what an extent imagination played a part in my early life, I may illustrate by another odd experience. Like most children, I was fond of jumping and developed an intense desire to support myself in the air.
Occasionally, a strong wind, richly charged with oxygen, blew from the mountains, rendering my body as light as a cork, and then I would leap and float in space for a long time. It was a delightful sensation, and my disappointment was keen when later I undeceived myself. During that period, I contracted many strange likes, dislikes, and habits, some of which I can trace to external impressions, while others are unaccountable. I had a violent aversion against the earrings of women, but other ornaments, as bracelets, pleased me more or less according to design. The sight of a pearl would almost give me a fit, but I was fascinated with the glitter of crystals or objects with sharp edges and plain surfaces.
I would not touch the hair of other people except, perhaps, at the point of a revolver. I would get a fever by looking at a peach, and if a piece of camphor was anywhere in the house, it caused me the keenest discomfort.
Even now, I'm not insensible to some of these upsetting impulses. When I drop little squares of paper in a dish filled with liquid, I always sense a peculiar and awful taste in my mouth. I counted the steps in my walks and calculated the cubical contents of soup plates, coffee cups, and pieces of food. Otherwise, my meal was unenjoyable. All repeated acts or operations I performed had to be divisible by 3, and if I missed, I felt impelled to do it all over again, even if it took hours. Up to the age of 8 years, my character was weak and vacillating. I had neither courage nor strength to form a firm resolve. My feelings came in waves and surges and vibrated unceasingly between extremes. My wishes were of consuming force, and like the heads of a hydra, they multiplied. I was oppressed by thoughts of pain in life and death, and religious fear. I was swayed by superstitious belief, and lived in constant dread of the spirit of evil, of ghosts and ogres and other unholy monsters of the dark. Then, all at once, there came a tremendous change, which altered the course of my whole existence. Of all things, I liked books the best. My father had a large library, and whenever I could manage, I tried to satisfy my passion for reading. He did not permit it, and would fly into a rage when he caught me in the act. He hid the candles when he found that I was reading in secret.
He did not want me to spoil my eyes, but I obtained tallow, made the wicking, and cast the sticks into tin forms, and every night I would bush the keyhole and the cracks and read, often till dawn, when all others slept, and my mother started on her arduous daily task. On one occasion, I came across a novel entitled Abafi, the Son of Abba, a Serbian translation of a well-known Hungarian writer, Josica. This work somehow awakened my dormant powers of will, and I began to practice self-control.
At first my resolutions faded like snow in April, but in a little while I conquered my weakness, and I felt pleasure I never knew before, that of doing as I willed. In the course of time, this vigorous mental exercise became second nature. At the outset, my wishes had to be subdued, but gradually desire and will grew to be identical.
After years of such discipline, I gained so complete a mastery over myself that I toyed with passions which have meant destruction to some of the strongest men.
At a certain age, I contracted a mania for gambling, which greatly worried my parents. To sit down to a game of cards was for me the quintessence of pleasure. My father led an exemplary life and could not excuse the senseless waste of time and money in which I indulged. I had a strong resolve, but my philosophy was bad.
I would say to him, "I can stop whenever I please, but is it worth while to give up that which I would purchase with the joys of paradise?" On frequent occasions he gave vent to his anger and contempt, but my mother was different.
She understood the character of men and knew that one's salvation could only be brought about through his own efforts. One afternoon, I remember, when I had lost all my money and was craving for a game, she came to me with a roll of bills and said, "Go and enjoy yourself. The sooner you lose all we possess, the better it will be. I know that you will get over it." She was right. I conquered my passion then and there and only regretted that it had not been 100 times as strong. I not only vanquished but tore it from my heart so as not to leave even a trace of desire. Ever since that time, I have been as indifferent to any form of gambling as to picking teeth. During another period, I smoked excessively, threatening to ruin my health. Then, my will asserted itself, and I not only stopped, but destroyed all inclination. Long ago I suffered from heart trouble, until I discovered that it was due to the innocent cup of coffee I consumed every morning. I discontinued at once, though I confess it was not an easy task.
In this way I checked and bridled other habits and passions, and have not only preserved my life, but derived an immense amount of satisfaction from what most men would consider privation and sacrifice.
After finishing the studies at the Polytechnic Institute and University, I had a complete nervous breakdown, and while the malady lasted, I observed many phenomena, strange and unbelievable. To be continued in our March issue. End of section 1.
Section 2 of My Inventions and Other Works, The Autobiography of Nikola Tesla, Electrical Experimenter, February to October 1919. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Kane Mercer. My Inventions, Part 2, My First Efforts at Invention, by Nikola Tesla. This article was published in Electrical Experimenter, March 1919.
Boys will be boys, the world over. The boy Tesla was no exception to the universal rule, as this, his second autobiographical article, clearly proves. As Mr. Tesla, in his own inimitable, delightful way, here paints with a literary artist's brush, his own intimate boyhood in charming as well as vivid colors. We have often heard of Tesla the dreamer, but if he is entitled to the epithet, his early boyhood certainly fails to reveal it. Tesla did not allow much grass to grow under his feet while a boy, for he assuredly was a strenuous, red-blooded youngster. You will wish to read all about the greatest inventor's early boyhood. It is doubly valuable because it comes from his own pen. We promise you an interesting 20 minutes entertainment. Editor.
I shall dwell briefly on these extraordinary experiences on the account of their possible interest to students of psychology and physiology, and also because this period of agony was of the greatest consequence on my mental development and subsequent labors. But it is indispensable to first relate the circumstances and conditions which preceded them, and in which might be found their partial explanation.
From childhood, I was compelled to concentrate attention upon myself. This caused me much suffering, but to my present view, it was a blessing in disguise, for it has taught me to appreciate the inestimable value of introspection in the preservation of life, as well as a means of achievement. The pressure of occupation and the incessant stream of impressions pouring into our consciousness through all the gateways of knowledge make modern existence hazardous in many ways. Most persons are so absorbed in the contemplation of the outside world that they are wholly oblivious to what is passing on within themselves. The premature death of millions is primarily traceable to this cause. Even among those who exercise care, it is a common mistake to avoid imaginary and ignore the real dangers. And what is true of an individual also applies, more or less, to a people as a whole.
Witness in illustration the prohibition movement. A drastic, if not unconstitutional, measure is now being put through in this country to prevent the consumption of alcohol, and yet it is a positive fact that coffee, tea, tobacco, chewing gum, and other stimulants, which are freely indulged in, even at the tender age, are vastly more injurious to the national body, judging from the number of those who succumb.
So, for instance, during my student years, I gathered from the published necrologues in Vienna, the home of coffee drinkers, that deaths from heart trouble sometimes reached 67% of the total. Similar observations might probably be made in cities where the consumption of tea is excessive. These delicious beverages superexcite and gradually exhaust the fine fibers of the brain. They also interfere seriously with arterial circulation and should be enjoyed all the more sparingly as their deleterious effects are slow and imperceptible. Tobacco, on the other hand, is conducive to easy and pleasant thinking, and detracts from the intensity and concentration necessary to all original and vigorous effort of the intellect. Chewing gum is helpful for a short while, but soon drains the glandular system and inflicts irreparable damage, not to speak of the revulsion it creates. Alcohol in small quantities is an excellent tonic, but is toxic in its action when absorbed in larger amounts, quite immaterial as to whether it is taken in as whiskey or produced in the stomach from sugar. But it should not be overlooked that all these are great eliminators, assisting nature, as they do, in upholding her stern but just law of survival of the fittest. Eager reformers should also be mindful of the eternal perversity of mankind, which makes the indifferent laissez-faire by far preferable to enforced restraint. The truth about this is that we need stimulants to do our best work under present living conditions, and that we must exercise moderation and control our appetites and inclinations in every direction.
That is what I've been doing for many years, in this way maintaining myself young in body and mind. Abstinence was not always to my liking, but I find ample reward in the agreeable experiences I am now making. Just in the hope of converting some to my precepts and convictions, I will recall one or two. A short time ago, I was returning to my hotel. It was a bitter, cold night, the ground slippery, and no taxi to be had. Half a block behind me followed another man, evidently as anxious as myself to get under cover.
Suddenly, my legs went up in the air. In the same instant, there was a flash in my brain. The nerves responded. The muscles contracted. I swung through 180 degrees and landed on my hands. I resumed my walk as though nothing had happened when the stranger caught up with me. "How old are you?" he asked, surveying me critically. "Oh, about 59," I replied. "What of it?" "Well," said he, "I have seen a cat do this, but never a man." About a month since, I wanted to order new eyeglasses and went to an oculist who put me through the usual tests. He looked at me incredulously as I read off with ease the smallest print at considerable distance. But when I told him that I was past 60, he gasped in astonishment. Friends of mine often remark that my suits fit me like gloves, but they do not know that all my clothing is made to measurements which were taken nearly 35 years ago and never changed. During this same period, my weight has not varied 1 pound. In this connection, I may tell a funny story. One evening, in the winter of 1885, Mr. Edison, Edward H. Johnson, the president of the Edison Illuminating Company, Mr. Batchelor, manager of the works, and myself entered a little place opposite 65 Fifth Avenue, where the offices of the company were located.
Someone suggested guessing weights, and I was induced to step on a scale.
Edison felt me all over and said, "Tesla weighs 152 pounds to an ounce," and he guessed it exactly. Stripped, I weighed 142 pounds, and that is still my weight. I whispered to Mr. Johnson, "How is it possible that Edison could guess my weight so closely?"
"Well," he said, lowering his voice, "I will tell you, confidentially, but you must not say anything. He was employed for a long time in a Chicago slaughterhouse, where he weighed thousands of hogs every day. That's why. My friend, the Honorable Chauncey M. Depew, tells of an Englishman on whom he sprung one of his original anecdotes and who listened with puzzled expression, but, a year later, laughed out loud. I will frankly confess it took me longer than that to appreciate Johnson's joke."
Now, my well-being is simply the result of a careful and measured mode of living, and perhaps the most astonishing thing is that three times in my youth I was rendered by illness a hopeless physical wreck and given up by physicians. More than this, through ignorance and lightheartedness, I got into all sorts of difficulties, dangers, and scrapes from which I extricated myself as by enchantment. I was almost drowned a dozen times, was nearly boiled alive, and just missed being cremated. I was entombed, lost, and frozen. I had hairbreadth escapes from mad dogs, hogs, and other wild animals. I passed through dreadful diseases, all kinds of odd mishaps, and that I am hale and hearty today seems like a miracle. But as I recall these incidents to my mind, I feel convinced that my preservation was not altogether accidental.
An inventor's endeavor is essentially life-saving. Whether he harnesses forces, improves devices, or provides new comforts and conveniences, he is adding to the safety of our existence.
He is also better qualified than the average individual to protect himself in peril, for he is observant and resourceful. If I had no other evidence that I was, in a measure, possessed of such qualities, I would find it in these personal experiences.
The reader will be able to judge for himself if I mention one or two instances.
On one occasion, when I was about 14 years old, I wanted to scare some friends who were bathing with me. My plan was to dive under a long floating structure and slip out quietly at the other end. Swimming and diving came to me as naturally as to a duck, and I was confident that I could perform the feat.
Accordingly, I plunged into the water and, when out of view, turned around and proceeded rapidly towards the opposite side.
Thinking that I was safely beyond the structure, I rose to the surface, but to my dismay, struck a beam. Of course, I quickly dived and forged ahead with rapid strokes until my breath was beginning to give out. Rising for the second time, my head came again in contact with a beam. Now I was becoming desperate. However, Summoning all my energy, I made a third frantic attempt, but the result was the same. The torture of suppressed breathing was getting unendurable. My brain was reeling and I felt myself sinking. At that moment, when my situation seemed absolutely hopeless, I experienced one of those flashes of light, and the structure above me appeared before my vision.
I either discerned or guessed that there was little space between the surface of the water and the boards resting on the beams, and, with consciousness nearly gone, I floated up, pressed my mouth close to the planks, and managed to inhale a little air, unfortunately mingled with a spray of water which nearly choked me. Several times I repeated this procedure, as in a dream, until my heart, which was racing at a terrible rate, quieted down, and I gained composure. After that, I made a number of unsuccessful dives, having completely lost the sense of direction, but finally succeeded in getting out of the trap when my friends had already given me up and were fishing for my body.
That bathing season was spoiled for me through recklessness, but I soon forgot the lesson, and only 2 years later I fell into a worse predicament.
There was a large flour mill with a dam across the river near the city where I was studying at the time. As a rule, the height of the water was only 2 or 3 inches above the dam, and to swim out to it was a sport not very dangerous, in which I often indulged.
One day, I went alone to the river to enjoy myself as usual. When I was a short distance from the masonry, however, I was horrified to observe that the water had risen and was carrying me along swiftly. I tried to get away, but it was too late. Luckily, though, I saved myself from being swept over by taking hold of the wall with both hands. The pressure against my chest was great, and I was barely able to keep my head above the surface. Not a soul was in sight, and my voice was lost in the roar of the fall.
Slowly and gradually, I became exhausted and unable to withstand the strain longer. Just as I was about to let go, to be dashed against the rocks below, I saw in a flash of light a familiar diagram illustrating the hydraulic principle that the pressure of a fluid in motion is proportionate to the area exposed, and automatically I turned on my left side.
As if by magic the pressure was reduced, and I found it comparatively easy in that position to resist the force of the stream. But the danger still confronted me. I knew that sooner or later I would be carried down, as it was not possible for any help to reach me in time, even if I attracted attention.
I am ambidextrous now, but then I was left-handed and had comparatively little strength in my right arm.
For this reason, I did not dare to turn on the other side to rest, and nothing remained but to slowly push my body along the dam. I had to get away from the mill towards which my face was turned, as the current there was much swifter and deeper.
It was a long and painful ordeal, and I came near to failing at its very end, for I was confronted with a depression in the masonry. I managed to get over with the last ounce of my force, and fell in a swoon when I reached the bank, where I was found. I had torn virtually all the skin from my left side, and it took several weeks before the fever subsided and I was well. These are only two of many instances, but they may be sufficient to show that, had it not been for the inventor's instinct, I would not have lived to tell this tale.
Interested people have often asked me how and when I began to invent. This I can only answer from my present recollection, in the light of which the first attempt I recall was rather ambitious, for it involved the invention of an apparatus and a method. In the former I was anticipated, but the latter was original. It happened in this way. One of my playmates had come to the possession of a hook and fishing tackle, which created quite an excitement in the village, and the next morning all started out to catch frogs. I was left alone and deserted owing to a quarrel with this boy. I had never seen a real hook and pictured it as something wonderful, endowed with peculiar qualities, and was despairing not to be one of the party. Urged by necessity, I somehow got hold of a piece of soft iron wire, hammered the end into a sharp point between two stones, bent it into shape, and fastened it to a strong string. Then I cut a rod, gathered some bait, and went down to the brook where there were frogs in abundance.
but I could not catch any and was almost discouraged when it occurred to me to dangle the empty hook in front of a frog sitting on a stump. At first he collapsed, but by and by his eyes bulged out and became bloodshot. He swelled to twice his normal size and made a vicious snap at the hook. Immediately I pulled him up. I tried the same thing again and again, and the method proved infallible. When my comrades, who in spite of their fine outfit had caught nothing, came to me, they were green with envy. For a long time I kept my secret and enjoyed the monopoly, but finally yielded to the spirit of Christmas. Every boy could then do the same, and the following summer brought disaster to the frogs.
In my next attempt, I seem to have acted under the first instinctive impulse which later dominated me, to harness the energies of nature to the service of man.
I did this through the medium of Maybugs, or Junebugs as they are called in America, which were a veritable pest in the country, and sometimes broke the branches of trees by the sheer weight of their bodies. The bushes were black with them. I would attach as many as four of them to a cross piece, rotably arranged on a thin spindle, and transmit the motion of the same to a larger disc, and so derive considerable power. These creatures were remarkably efficient, for once they were started, they had no sense to stop and continued whirling for hours and hours, and the hotter it was, the harder they worked. All went well until a strange boy came to the place. He was the son of a retired officer in the Austrian army. That urchin ate Maybugs alive and enjoyed them as though they were the finest Blue Point oysters.
That disgusting sight terminated my endeavors in this promising field, and I have never since been able to touch a Maybug or any other insect for that matter. After that, I believe, I undertook to take apart and assemble the clocks of my grandfather. In the former operation, I was always successful, but often failed to the latter. So it came that he brought my work to a sudden halt in a matter not too delicate, and it took 30 years before I tackled another clockwork again. Shortly thereafter, I went into the manufacture of a kind of popgun which comprised a hollow tube, a piston, and two plugs of hemp. When firing the gun, the piston was pressed against the stomach, and the tube was pushed back quickly with both hands. The air between the plugs was compressed and raised to high temperature, and one of them was expelled with a loud report. The art consisted in selecting a tube of the proper taper from the hollow stalks. I did very well with that gun, but my activities interfered with the window panes in our household and met with painful discouragement. If I remember rightly, I then took to carving swords from pieces of furniture which I could conveniently obtain. At that time, I was under the sway of the Serbian national poetry and full of admiration for the feats of the heroes. I used to spend hours in mowing down my enemies in the form of corn stalks, which ruined the crops and netted me several spankings from my mother. Moreover, these were not of the formal kind, but the genuine article. I had all this and more behind me before I was 6 years old and had passed through 1 year of elementary school in the village of Similjan where I was born. At this juncture, we moved to the little city of Gospic nearby. This change of residence was like a calamity to me. It almost broke my heart to part from our pigeons, chickens, and sheep, and our magnificent flock of geese, which used to rise to the clouds in the morning and return from the feeding grounds at sundown in battle formation, so perfect that it would have put a squadron of the very best aviators of the present day to shame.
In our new house, I was but a prisoner, watching the strange people I saw through the window blinds. My bashfulness was such that I would rather have faced a roaring lion than one of the city dudes who strolled about. But my hardest trial came on Sunday when I had to dress up and attend the service. There, I meet with an accident, the mere thought of which made my blood curdle like sour milk for years afterwards.
It was my second adventure in a church. Not long before I was entombed for a night in an old chapel on an inaccessible mountain, which was visited only once a year. It was an awful experience, but this one was worse. There was a wealthy lady in town, a good but pompous woman, who used to come to church gorgeously painted up and attired with an enormous train and attendants. One Sunday I had just finished ringing the bell in the belfry and rushed downstairs when this grand dame was sweeping out and I jumped on her train. It tore off with a ripping noise which sounded like a salvo of musketry fired by raw recruits. My father was livid with rage. He gave me a gentle slap on the cheek, the only corporal punishment he ever administered to me, but I almost feel it now. The embarrassment and confusion that followed are indescribable. I was practically ostracized until something else happened that redeemed me in the estimation of the community.
An enterprising young merchant had organized a fire department. A new fire engine was purchased, uniforms provided, and men drilled for service and parade. The engine was, in reality, a pump to be worked by 16 men and was beautifully painted red and black. One afternoon, the official trial was prepared for, and the machine was transported to the river. The entire population turned out to witness the great spectacle. When all the speeches and ceremonies were concluded, the command was given to pump, but not a drop of water came from the nozzle. The professors and experts tried in vain to locate the trouble. The fizzle was complete when I arrived at the scene. My knowledge of the mechanism was nil, and I knew next to nothing of air pressure, but instinctively I felt for the suction hose in the water and found that it had collapsed. When I waded in the river and opened it up, the water rushed forth, and not a few Sunday clothes were spoiled. Archimedes running naked through the streets of Syracuse and shouting "Eureka!" at the top of his voice did not make a greater impression than myself. I was carried on the shoulders and was the hero of the day. Upon settling in the city, I began a 4 years course in the so-called normal school preparatory to my studies at the college or real gymnasium.
During this period, my boyish efforts and exploits, as well as troubles, continued.
Among other things, I attained the unique distinction of champion crow catcher in the country. My method of procedure was extremely simple. I would go in the forest, hide in the bushes, and imitate the call of the bird. Usually I would get several answers, and in a short while a crow would flutter down into the shrubbery near me. After that, all I needed to do was to throw a piece of cardboard to distract its attention, jump up and grab it before it could extricate itself from the undergrowth. In this way I could capture as many as I desired, but on one occasion something occurred which made me respect them. I had caught a fine pair of birds and was returning home with a friend. When we left the forest, thousands of crows had gathered, making a frightful racket. In a few minutes they rose in pursuit and soon enveloped us. The fun lasted until all of a sudden I received a blow on the back of my head, which knocked me down. Then they attacked me viciously. I was compelled to release the two birds and was glad to join my friend who had taken refuge in a cave. In the schoolroom, there were a few mechanical models which interested me and turned my attention to water turbines. I constructed many of these and found great pleasure in operating them. How extraordinary was my life, an incident may illustrate. My uncle had no use for this kind of pastime, and more than once rebuked me.
I was fascinated by a description of Niagara Falls I had perused, and pictured in my imagination a big wheel run by the falls.
I told my uncle that I would go to America and carry out this scheme. 30 years later, I saw my ideas carried out at Niagara, and marveled at the unfathomable mystery of the mind.
I made all kinds of other contrivances and contraptions, but among these the arbalists I produced were the best. My arrows, when shot, disappeared from sight, and at close range traversed a plank of pine 1 inch thick. Through the continuous tightening of the bows, I developed skin on my stomach very much like that of a crocodile, and I am often wondering whether it is due to this exercise that I am able even now to digest cobblestones. Nor can I pass in silence my performances with the sling, which would have enabled me to give a stunning exhibit at the Hippodrome. And now I will tell of one of my feats with this antique implement of war, which will strain to the utmost the credulity of the reader. I was practicing while walking with my uncle along the river. The sun was setting, the trout were playful, and from time to time one would shoot up into the air, its glistening body sharply defined against the projecting rock beyond. Of course, any boy might have hit a fish under these propitious conditions, but I undertook a much more difficult task, and I foretold to my uncle, to the minutest detail, what I intended doing. I was to hurl a stone to meet the fish, press its body against the rock, and cut it in two. It was no sooner said than done. My uncle looked at me, almost scared out of his wits, and exclaimed, "Vade retro Satanas!" And it was a few days before he spoke to me again. Other records, however great, will be eclipsed, but I feel that I could peacefully rest on my laurels for 1,000 years.
In the April issue, Mr. Tesla will describe in detail how he conceived one of his most important and far-reaching inventions, the rotary magnetic field. Editor. End of section 2. Section 3. Of My Inventions and Other Works. The Autobiography of Nikola Tesla. Electrical Experimenter, February to October 1919. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Kane Mercer. My Inventions, Part 3. My Later Endeavors, The Discovery of the Rotating Magnetic Field, by Nikola Tesla. This article was published in Electrical Experimenter, April 1919. This installment, no doubt the most interesting of the three published so far, reveals many extraordinary occurrences and experiences in the world's greatest inventor's life, experiences such as do not fall on the lot of ordinary mortals. And Tesla, the many-sided, aside from inventing, knows the rare art of painting word pictures. He does so here in a masterly fashion. He tells us how he finally conceived the induction motor, perhaps his greatest discovery, the invention which changed the face of the globe, the invention which made possible the streetcar, the subway, the electric train, power transmission, the harnessing of waterfalls, and countless others. But let Tesla tell you himself how it all came about. It is a classic worth reading. Editor. What is the induction motor? The induction motor operates on alternating current. It has no commutator like a direct current motor, nor slip rings like an alternating current motor. Contrary to the two types just cited, the field current is not steady, but the current itself rotates constantly, pulling around with it, by induction, the only moving part of the motor, the rotor or armature. Having no armature nor slip rings, the induction motor never sparks. It consequently knows no brush trouble. It needs no attention because of its ruggedness. Only the bearings wear out. Its efficiency, too, is higher. On account of all this, the induction motor is used in a preponderant proportion in streetcars, electric trains, factories, etc.
At the age of 10, I entered the Real Gymnasium, which was a new and fairly well-equipped institution. In the Department of Physics were various models of classical scientific apparatus, electrical and mechanical. The demonstrations and experiments performed from time to time by the instructors fascinated me and were undoubtedly a powerful incentive to invention. I was also passionately fond of mathematical studies and often won the professor's praise for rapid calculation. This was due to my acquired faculty of visualizing the figures and performing the operations, not in the usual intuitive manner, but as in actual life. Up to a certain degree of complexity, it was absolutely the same to me whether I wrote the symbols on the board or conjured them before my mental vision. But freehand drawing, to which many hours of the course were devoted, was an annoyance I could not endure. This is rather remarkable, as most of the members of the family excelled in it.
Perhaps my aversion was simply due to the predilection I found in undisturbed thought. Had it not been for a few exceptionally stupid boys who could not do anything at all, my record would have been the worst. It was a serious handicap as under the then existing educational regime, drawing being obligatory, this deficiency threatened to spoil my whole career, and my father had considerable trouble in railroading me from one class to another.
In the second year at that institution, I became obsessed with the idea of producing continuous motion through steady air pressure. The pump incident, of which I have told, had set afire my youthful imagination and impressed me with the boundless abilities of a vacuum. I grew frantic in my desire to harness this inexhaustible energy, but for a long time I was groping in the dark.
Finally, however, my endeavors crystallized in an invention which was to enable me to achieve what no other mortal ever attempted. Imagine a cylinder freely rotatable on two bearings, partly surrounded by a rectangular trough, which fits it perfectly.
The open side of the trough is closed by a partition so that the cylindrical segment within the enclosure divides the latter into two compartments, entirely separated from each other by airtight sliding joints.
One of these compartments being sealed and once for all exhausted, the other remaining open, a perpetual rotation of the cylinder would result, at least, I thought so. A wooden model was constructed and fitted with infinite care, and when I applied the pump on one side and actually observed that there was a tendency to turning, I was delirious with joy. Mechanical flight was the one thing I wanted to accomplish, although still under the discouraging recollection of a bad fall I sustained by jumping with an umbrella from the top of a building.
Every day I used to transport myself through the air to distant regions, but I could not understand just how I managed to do it. Now I had something concrete, a flying machine with nothing more than a rotating shaft, flapping wings, and a vacuum of unlimited power. From that time on, I made my daily aerial excursions in a vehicle of comfort and luxury, as might have befitted King Solomon.
It took years before I understood that the atmospheric pressure acted at right angles to the surface of the cylinder, and that the slight rotary effort I observed was due to a leak. Though this knowledge came gradually, it gave me a painful shock.
I had hardly completed my course at the Real Gymnasium when I was prostrated with a dangerous illness, or rather a score of them, and my condition became so desperate that I was given up by physicians.
During this period, I was permitted to read constantly, obtaining books from the public library which had been neglected and entrusted to me for classification of the works and preparation of the catalogues.
One day I was handed a few volumes of new literature unlike anything I had ever read before, and so captivating as to make me utterly forget my hopeless state. They were the earlier works of Mark Twain, and to them might have been due the miraculous recovery which followed. 25 years later, when I met Mr. Clemens and we formed a friendship between us, I told him of the experience and was amazed to see that the great man of laughter burst into tears.
My studies were continued at the Higher Real Gymnasium in Karlstad, Croatia, where one of my aunts resided.
She was a distinguished lady, the wife of a colonel who was an old war horse, having participated in many battles. I never can forget the 3 years I passed at their home.
No fortress in time of war was under a more rigid discipline.
I was fed like a canary bird. All the meals were of the highest quality and deliciously prepared, but short in quantity by 1,000%. The slices of ham cut by my aunt were like tissue paper. When the colonel would put something substantial on my plate, she would snatch it away and say excitedly to him, "Be careful, Nico is very delicate." I had a voracious appetite and suffered like Tantalus, but I lived in an atmosphere of refinement and artistic taste quite unusual for those times and conditions.
The land was low and marshy, and malaria fever never left me while there, despite of the enormous amounts of quinine I consumed. Occasionally the river would rise and drive an army of rats into the buildings, devouring everything, even to the bundles of the fierce paprika.
These pests were to me a welcome diversion. I thinned their ranks by all sorts of means, which won me the unenviable distinction of rat catcher in the community. At last, however, my course was completed, the misery ended, and I obtained the certificate of maturity which brought me to the crossroads.
During all those years, my parents never wavered in their resolve to make me embrace the clergy, the mere thought of which filled me with dread. I had become intensely interested in electricity under the stimulating influence of my professor of physics, who was an ingenious man and often demonstrated the principles by apparatus of his own invention.
Among these, I recall a device in the shape of a freely rotatable bulb with tin foil coatings, which was made to spin rapidly when connected to a static machine.
It is impossible for me to convey an adequate idea of the intensity of feeling I experienced in witnessing his exhibitions of these mysterious phenomena. Every impression produced 1,000 echoes in my mind. I wanted to know more of this wonderful force. I longed for experiment and investigation, and resigned myself to the inevitable with aching heart. Just as I was making ready for the long journey home, I received word that my father wished me to go on a shooting expedition. It was a strange request, as he had always been strenuously opposed to this kind of sport.
But a few days later, I learned that the cholera was raging in that district, and, taking advantage of an opportunity, I returned to Gospic in disregard of my parents' wishes. It was incredible how absolutely ignorant people were as to the causes of this scourge which visited the country in intervals from 15 to 20 years.
They thought that the deadly agents were transmitted through the air and filled it with pungent odors and smoke. In the meantime, they drank the infected water and died in heaps. I contracted the awful disease on the very day of my arrival, and although surviving the crisis, I was confined to bed for 9 months with scarcely any ability to move. My energy was completely exhausted, and for the second time I found myself at death's door. In one of the sinking spells, which was thought to be the last, my father rushed into the room. I still see his pallid face as he tried to cheer me in tones belaying his assurance. "Perhaps," I said, "I may get well if you let me study engineering." "You will go to the best technical institution in the world," he solemnly replied, and I knew that he meant it. A heavy weight was lifted from my mind, but the relief would have come too late had it not been for a marvelous cure brought about through a bitter decoction of a peculiar bean. I came to life like another Lazarus, to the utter amazement of everybody. My father insisted that I spend a year in healthful physical outdoor exercises, to which I reluctantly consented. For most of this term, I roamed in the mountains, loaded with a hunter's outfit and a bundle of books, and this contact with nature made me stronger in body as well as in mind.
I thought and planned, and conceived many ideas almost as a rule delusive. The vision was clear enough, but the knowledge of principles was very limited. In one of my inventions, I proposed to convey letters and packages across the seas, through a submarine tube, in spherical containers of sufficient strength to resist the hydraulic pressure.
The pumping plant, intended to force the water through the tube, was accurately figured and designed, and all other particulars carefully worked out. Only one trifling detail, of no consequence, was lightly dismissed.
I assumed an arbitrary velocity of the water, and, what is more, took pleasure in making it high, thus arriving at a stupendous performance supported by faultless calculations.
Subsequent reflections, however, on the resistance of pipes to fluid flow determined me to make this invention public property.
Another one of my projects was to construct a ring around the equator which would, of course, float freely and could be arrested in its spinning motion by reactionary forces, thus enabling travel at a rate of about 1,000 miles an hour, impracticable by rail. The reader will smile. The plan was difficult of execution, I will admit,
but not nearly so bad as that of a well-known New York professor
who wanted to pump the air from the torrid to temperate zones, entirely forgetful of the fact that the Lord had provided a gigantic machine for this very purpose.
Still another scheme, far more important and attractive, was to derive power from the rotational energy of terrestrial bodies.
I had discovered that objects on the Earth's surface, owing to the diurnal rotation of the globe, are carried by the same alternately, in and against the direction of translatory movement.
From this results a great change in momentum, which could be utilized in the simplest imaginable manner to furnish motive effort in any habitable region of the world.
I cannot find words to describe my disappointment when later I realized that I was in the predicament of Archimedes, who vainly sought for a fixed point in the universe. At the termination of my vacation, I was sent to the Polytechnic School in Graz, Styria, which my father had chosen as one of the oldest and best reputed institutions. That was the moment I had eagerly awaited, and I began my studies under good auspices and firmly resolved to succeed. My previous training was above average due to my father's teaching and opportunities afforded. I had acquired the knowledge of a number of languages and waded through the books of several libraries, picking up information more or less useful.
Then again, for the first time, I could choose my subjects as I liked, and freehand drawing was to bother me no more. I had made up my mind to give my parents a surprise, and during the whole first year I regularly started my work at 3 o'clock in the morning and continued until 11 at night, no Sundays or holidays excepted.
As most of my fellow students took things easily, naturally enough I eclipsed all records. In the course of that year, I passed through 9 exams, and the professors thought I deserved more than the highest qualifications. Armed with their flattering certificates, I went home for a short rest, expecting a triumph, and was mortified when my father made light of these hard-won honors.
That almost killed my ambition, but later, after he had died, I was pained to find a package of letters which the professors had written him to the effect that unless he took me away from the institution, I would be killed through overwork. Thereafter, I devoted myself chiefly to physics, mechanics, and mathematical studies, spending the hours of leisure in the libraries. I had a veritable mania for finishing whatever I began, which often got me into difficulties.
On one occasion, I started to read the works of Voltaire when I learned, to my dismay, that there were close on 100 large volumes in small print which that monster had written while drinking 72 cups of black coffee per diem. It had to be done, but when I laid aside the last book, I was very glad and said, "Never more." My first year's showing had won me the appreciation and friendship of several professors. Among these were Professor Rogner, who was teaching arithmetical subjects and geometry, Professor Poschel, who held the chair of theoretical and experimental physics, and Dr. Allais, who taught integral calculus and specialized in differential equations.
This scientist was the most brilliant lecturer to whom I've ever listened. He took a special interest in my progress and would frequently remain for an hour or two in the lecture room, giving me problems to solve, in which I delighted. To him I explained a flying machine I'd conceived, not an illusionary invention, but one based on sound scientific principles, which has become realizable through my turbine and will soon be given to the world.
Both professors, Rogner and Poschel, were curious men. The former had peculiar ways of expressing himself, and whenever he did so, there was a riot, followed by a long and embarrassing pause. Professor Poschel was a methodical and thoroughly grounded German. He had enormous feet and hands like the paws of a bear. But all of his experiments were skillfully performed with lock-like precision and without a miss.
It was the second year of my studies that we received a Gram dynamo from Paris, having the horseshoe form of a laminated field magnet and a wire-wound armature with a commutator. It was connected up and various effects of the currents were shown. While Professor Poschel was making demonstrations, running the machine as a motor, the brushes gave trouble, sparking badly, and I observed that it might be possible to operate a motor without these appliances. But he declared that it could not be done, and did me the honor of delivering a lecture on the subject, at the conclusion of which he remarked,
"Mr. Tesla may accomplish great things, but he certainly never will do this. It would be equivalent to converting a steadily pulling force, like that of gravity, into a rotary effort. It is a perpetual motion scheme, an impossible idea."
But instinct is something which transcends knowledge. We have, undoubtedly, certain finer fibers that enable us to perceive truths when logical deduction or any other willful effort of the brain is futile. For a time, I wavered, impressed by the professor's authority, but soon became convinced I was right and undertook the task with all the fire and boundless confidence of youth. I started by first picturing in my mind a direct current machine, running it and following the changing flow of the currents in the armature. Then I would imagine an alternator and investigate the process taking place in a similar manner. Next, I would visualize systems comprising motors and generators and operate them in various ways. The images I saw were to me perfectly real and tangible. All my remaining term in Graz was passed in intense but fruitless efforts of this kind, and I almost came to the conclusion that the problem was insolvable. In 1880, I went to Prague, Bohemia, carrying out my father's wish to complete my education at the university there. It was in that city that I made a decided advance, which consisted in detaching the commutator from the machine and studying the phenomena in this new aspect, but still without result. In the year following, there was a sudden change in my views of life. I realized that my parents had been making two great sacrifices on my account and resolved to relieve them of the burden. The wave of the American telephone had just reached the European continent, and the system was to be installed in Budapest, Hungary. It appeared an ideal opportunity, all the more as a friend of our family was at the head of the enterprise. It was here that I suffered the complete breakdown of the nerves to which I have referred. What I experienced during the period of that illness surpasses all belief. My sight and hearing were always extraordinary. I could clearly discern objects in the distance when others saw no trace of them. Several times in my boyhood, I saved the houses of our neighbors from fire by hearing the faint crackling sounds which did not disturb their sleep and calling for help. In 1899, when I was past 40 and carrying on my experiments in Colorado, I could hear, very distinctly, thunderclaps at a distance of 550 miles. The limit of audition for my young assistants was scarcely more than 150 miles. My ear was thus over 13 times more sensitive. Yet at that time, I was, so to speak, stone deaf in comparison with the acuteness of my hearing while under the nervous strain. In Budapest, I could hear the ticking of a watch with three rooms between me and the timepiece. A fly alighting on the table in the room would cause a dull thud in my ear. A carriage passing at a distance of a few miles fairly shook my whole body. The whistle of a locomotive 20 or 30 miles away made the bench or chair on which I sat vibrate so strongly that the pain was unbearable. The ground under my feet trembled continuously. I had to support my bed on rubber cushions to get any rest at all. The roaring noises from near and far often produced the effect of spoken words which often would have frightened me had I not been able to resolve them into their accidental components. The sun's rays, when periodically intercepted, would cause blows of such force in my brain that they would stun me. I had to summon all my willpower to pass under a bridge or other structure as I experienced a crushing pressure on the skull. In the dark, I had the sense of a bat and could detect the presence of an object at a distance of 12 feet by a peculiar creepy sensation on the forehead. My pulse varied from a few to 260 beats, and all tissues of the body quivered with twitchings and tremors, which was perhaps the hardest to bear. A renowned physician, who gave me daily large doses of bromide of potassium, pronounced my malady unique and incurable. It is my eternal regret that I was not under the observation of experts in physiology and psychology at that time. I clung desperately to life, but never expected to recover. Can anyone believe that so helpless a physical wreck could ever be transformed into a man of astonishing strength and tenacity, able to work 38 years, almost without a day's interruption, and find himself still strong and fresh in body and mind? Such is my case. A powerful desire to live and to continue the work, and the assistance of a devoted friend and athlete accomplished the wonder. My health returned, and with it the vigor of mind. In attacking the problem again, I almost regretted that the struggle was soon to end. I had so much energy to spare. When I undertook the task, it was not with a resolve such as men often make. With me, it was a sacred vow, a question of life and death. I knew that I would perish if I failed. Now I felt that the battle was won. Back in the deep recesses of the brain was the solution, but I could not yet give it outward expression. One afternoon, which is ever present in my recollection, I was enjoying a walk with a friend in the city park and reciting poetry. At that age, I knew entire books by heart, word for word.
One of these was Goethe's Faust. The sun was just setting and reminded me of the glorious passage. Sie rückt und weit, der Tag ist überlebt, dort eilet sie hin und fordert neues Leben. Oh, dass kein Flügel mich vom Boden hebt, noch und immer noch zu streben. Ein schöner Traum, in dessen sie entweicht, auch süde Geistes Flügen wird so leicht, kein körperlicher Flügel sich gesellen. The glow retreats, done is the day of toil. It yonder hastes, new fields of life exploring. Ah, that no wing can lift me from the soil, upon its track to follow, follow soaring. A glorious dream, though now the glories fade. Alas, the wings that lift the mind no aid, of wings to lift the body can bequeath me.
As I uttered these inspiring words, the idea came to me like a flash of lightning, and in an instant, the truth was revealed. I drew with a stick on the sand the diagrams shown 6 years later in my address before the American Institute of Electrical Engineers, and my companion understood them perfectly. The images I saw were wonderfully sharp and clear and had the solidity of metal and stone, so much so that I told him, "See my motor here? Watch me reverse it." I cannot begin to describe my emotions.
Pygmalion, seeing his statue come to life, could not have been more deeply moved. A thousand secrets of nature which I have stumbled upon accidentally I would have given, for that one which I had wrestled from her against all odds and at the peril of my existence. End of section 3.
Section 4 of My Inventions and Other Works of Nikola Tesla, Electrical Experimenter, February to October 1919. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Avai in December 2018. My Inventions, Part 4. The Discovery of the Tesla Coil and Transformer by Nikola Tesla. This article was published in Electrical Experimenter, May 1919. For a while I gave myself up entirely to the intense enjoyment of picturing machines and devising new forms. It was a mental state of happiness about as complete as I have ever known in life. Ideas came in an uninterrupted stream, and the only difficulty I had was to hold them fast. The pieces of apparatus I conceived were to me absolutely real and tangible in every detail, even to the minutest marks and signs of wear. I delighted in imagining the motors constantly running, for in this way they presented to the mind's eye a more fascinating sight. When natural inclination develops into a passionate desire, one advances towards his goal in 7-league boots. In less than 2 months I evolved virtually all the types of motors and modifications of the system which are now identified with my name. It was, perhaps, providential that the necessities of existence commanded a temporary halt to this consuming activity of the mind. I came to Budapest prompted by a premature report concerning the telephone enterprise, and, as irony of fate willed it, I had to accept a position as draftsman in the Central Telegraph Office of the Hungarian government at a salary which I deem it my privilege not to disclose. Fortunately, I soon won the interest of the inspector-in-chief and was thereafter employed on calculations, designs, and estimates in connections with new installations, until the telephone exchange was started, when I took charge of the same. The knowledge and practical experience I gained in the course of this work was most valuable, and the employment gave me ample opportunities for the exercise of my inventive faculties. I made several improvements in the central station apparatus and perfected a telephone repeater or amplifier, which was never patented or publicly described, but would be creditable to me even today. In recognition of my efficient assistance, the organizer of the undertaking, Mr. Puskas, upon disposing of his business in Budapest, offered me a position in Paris, which I gladly accepted. I never can forget the deep impression that magic city produced on my mind. For several days after my arrival, I roamed through the streets in utter bewilderment of the new spectacle. The attractions were many and irresistible, but, alas, the income was spent as soon as received. When Mr. Puskas asked me how I was getting along in the new sphere, I described the situation accurately in the statement that the last 29 days of the month are the toughest. I led a rather strenuous life in what would now be termed Rooseveltian fashion. Every morning, regardless of weather, I would go from the Boulevard Saint-Marcel, where I resided, to a bathing house on the Seine, plunge into the water, loop the circuit 27 times, and then walk an hour to reach Ivry, where the company's factory was located. There I would have a good woodchopper's breakfast at 7:30, and then eagerly await the lunch hour, in the meanwhile cracking hard nuts for the manager of the works, Mr. Charles Batchelor, who was an intimate friend and assistant of Edison. Here I was thrown in contact with a few Americans who fairly fell in love with me because of my proficiency in billiards. To these men I explained my invention, and one of them, Mr. D. Cunningham, foreman of the mechanical department, offered to form a stock company. The proposal seemed to me comical in the extreme. I did not have the faintest conception of what that meant, except that it was an American way of doing things. Nothing came of it, however, and during the next few months I had to travel from one to another place in France and Germany to cure the ills of the power plants. On my return to Paris I submitted to one of the administrators of the company, Mr. Rau, a plan for improving their dynamos, and was given an opportunity. My success was complete, and the delighted directors accorded me the privilege of developing automatic regulators, which were much desired. Shortly after, there was some trouble with the lightning plant which had been installed at the new railroad station in Strasbourg, Alsace. The wiring was defective, and on the occasion of the opening ceremonies, a large part of a wall was blown out through a short circuit, right in the presence of old Emperor William I. The German government refused to take the plant, and the French company was facing a serious loss. On account of my knowledge of the German language and past experience, I was entrusted with the difficult task of straightening out matters, and early in 1883 I went to Strasbourg on that mission. The first induction motor is built. Some of the incidents in that city have left an indelible record on my memory. By a curious coincidence, a number of men who subsequently achieved fame lived there about that time. In later life, I used to say, there were bacteria of greatness in that old town. Others caught the disease, but I escaped. The practical work, correspondence and conferences with officials, kept me preoccupied day and night, but as soon as I was able to manage, I undertook the construction of a simple motor in a mechanical shop opposite the railroad station, having brought with me from Paris some material for that purpose. The consummation of the experiment was, however, delayed until the summer of that year, when I finally had the satisfaction of seeing rotation effected by alternating currents of different phase, and without sliding contacts or commutator, as I had conceived a year before. It was an exquisite pleasure, but not to compare with the delirium of joy following the first revelation. Among my new friends was the former mayor of the city, Mr. Bauzin, whom I had already in a measure acquainted with this and other inventions of mine, and whose support I endeavoured to enlist. He was sincerely devoted to me and put my project before several wealthy persons, but, to my mortification, found no response. He wanted to help me in every possible way, and the approach of the 1st of July 1919 happens to remind me of a form of assistance I received from that charming man, which was not financial, but nonetheless appreciated. In 1870, when the Germans invaded the country, Mr. Bozin had buried a good-sized allotment of Saint-Estèphe of 1801, and he came to the conclusion that he knew no worthier person than myself to consume that precious beverage. This, I may say, is one of the unforgettable incidents to which I have referred. My friend urged me to return to Paris as soon as possible and seek support there. This I was anxious to do, but my work and negotiations were protracted owing to all sorts of petty obstacles I encountered, so that at times the situation seemed hopeless. German efficiency. Just to give an idea of German thoroughness and efficiency, I may mention here a rather funny experience. An incandescent lamp of 16 candle power was to be placed in a hallway, and upon selecting the proper location, I ordered the monteur to run the wires. After working for a while, he concluded that the engineer had to be consulted, and this was done. The latter made several objections, but ultimately agreed that the lamp should be placed 2 inches from the spot I had assigned, whereupon the work proceeded. Then the engineer became worried and told me that Inspector Avardek should be notified. That important person called, investigated, debated, and decided that the lamp should be shifted back 2 inches, which was the place I had marked. It was not long, however, before Avardek got cold feet himself and advised me that he had informed Oberinspector Hieronymus of the matter, and that I should await his decision. It was several days before the Oberinspector was able to free himself of other pressing duties, but at last he arrived and a two-hour debate followed, when he decided to move the lamp 2 inches farther. My hopes that this was the final act were shattered when the Oberinspector returned and said to me, "Regierungsrat Funke is so particular that I would not dare to give an order for placing this lamp without his explicit approval." Accordingly, arrangements for a visit from this great man were made. We started cleaning up and polishing early in the morning. Everybody brushed up, I put up my gloves, and when Funke came with his retinue, he was ceremoniously received. After 2 hours' deliberation, he suddenly exclaimed, "I must be going," and pointed to a place on the ceiling. He ordered me to put the lamp there. It was the exact spot which I had originally chosen. So it went day after day with variations, but I was determined to achieve at whatever cost, and in the end my efforts were rewarded. By the spring of 1884 all the differences were adjusted, the plant formally accepted, and I returned to Paris with pleasing anticipations. One of the administrators had promised me a liberal compensation in case I succeeded, as well as a fair consideration of the improvements I had made in their dynamos, and I hoped to realize a substantial sum. There were three administrators whom I shall designate as A, B, and C, for convenience. When I called on A, he told me that B had the say. This gentleman thought that only C could decide, and the latter was quite sure that A alone had the power to act. After several laps of this circulus vitiosus, it dawned upon me that my reward was a castle in Spain. The utter failure of my attempts to raise capital for development was another disappointment, and when Mr. Batchelor pressed me to go to America with a view of redesigning the Edison machines, I determined to try my fortunes in the land of golden promise. But the chance was nearly missed. I liquefied my modest assets, secured accommodations, and found myself at the railroad station as the train was pulling out. At that moment I discovered that my money and tickets were gone. What to do was the question. Hercules had plenty of time to deliberate, but I had to decide while running alongside the train, with opposite feelings surging in my brain like condenser oscillation. Resolve, helped by dexterity, won out in the nick of time, and upon passing through the usual experiences, as trivial as unpleasant, I managed to embark for New York with the remnants of my belongings, some poems and articles I had written, and a package of calculations relating to solutions of an unsolvable integral, and to my flying machine. During the voyage I sat most of the time at the stern of the ship, watching for an opportunity to save somebody from a watery grave, without the slightest thought of danger. Later, when I had absorbed some of the practical American sense, I shivered at the recollection, and marveled at my former folly. Tesla in America. I wish that I could put in words my first impressions of this country. In the Arabian tales I read how genii transported people into a land of dreams to live through delightful adventures. My case was just the reverse. The genii had carried me from a world of dreams into one of realities. What I had left was beautiful, artistic, and fascinating in every way. What I saw here was machined, rough, and unattractive. A burly policeman was twirling his stick, which looked to me as big as a log. I approached him politely with the request to direct me. 6 blocks down, then to the left, he said, with murder in his eyes. Is this America? I asked myself in painful surprise. It is a century behind Europe in civilization. When I went abroad in 1889, 5 years having elapsed since my arrival here, I became convinced that it was more than 100 years ahead of Europe, and nothing has happened to this day to change my opinion. Tesla meets Edison. The meeting with Edison was a memorable event in my life. I was amazed at this wonderful man who, without early advantages and scientific training, had accomplished so much. I had studied a dozen languages, delved in literature and art, and had spent my best years in libraries reading all sorts of stuff that fell into my hands, from Newton's Principia to the novels of Paul de Kock, and felt that most of my life had been squandered. But it did not take long before I recognized that it was the best thing I could have done. Within a few weeks I had won Edison's confidence, and it came about in this way. The SS Oregon, the fastest passenger steamer at that time, had both of its lightning machines disabled, and its sailing was delayed. As the superstructure had been built after their installation, it was impossible to remove them from the hold. The predicament was a serious one, and Edison was much annoyed. In the evening I took the necessary instruments with me and went aboard the vessel, where I stayed for the night. The dynamos were in bad conditions, having several short circuits and breaks, but with the assistance of the crew I succeeded in putting them in good shape. At 5 o'clock in the morning, when passing along Fifth Avenue on my way to the shop, I met Edison with Batchelor and a few others as they were returning home to retire. "Here is our Parisian running around at night," he said. When I told him that I was coming from the Oregon and had repaired both machines, he looked at me in silence and walked away without another word. But when he had gone some distance I heard him remark, "Batchelor, this is a damn good man," and from that time on I had fully freedom in directing the work. For nearly a year my regular hours were from 10 a.m. until 5 o'clock the next morning, without a day's exception. Edison said to me, "I have had many hard-working assistants, but you take the cake." During this period I designed 24 different types of standard machines with short cores and of uniform pattern, which replaced the old ones. The manager had promised me $50,000 on the completion of this task, but it turned out to be a practical joke. This gave me a painful shock, and I resigned my position. Immediately thereafter, some people approached me with the proposal of forming an arc light company under my name, to which I agreed. Here finally was an opportunity to develop the motor, but when I broached the subject to my new associates, they said, "No, we want the arc lamp. We don't care for this alternating current of yours." In 1886 my system of arc lighting was perfected and adopted for factory and municipal lighting, and I was free, but with no other possession than a beautifully engraved certificate of stock of hypothetical value. Then followed a period of struggle in the new medium, for which I was not fitted, but the reward came in the end, and in April 1887 the Tesla Electric Company was organized, providing a laboratory and facilities. The motors I built there were exactly as I had imagined them. I made no attempt to improve the design, but merely reproduced the pictures as they appeared to my vision, and the operation was always as I expected. In the early part of 1888, an arrangement was made with the Westinghouse Company for the manufacture of the motors on a large scale. But great difficulties had still to be overcome. My system was based on the use of low-frequency currents, and the Westinghouse experts had adopted 133 cycles with the object of securing advantages in the transformation. They did not want to depart from their standard forms of apparatus, and my efforts had to be concentrated upon adapting the motor to these conditions. Another necessity was to produce a motor capable of running efficiently at this frequency on two wires, which was not easy of accomplishment. At the close of 1889, however, my services in Pittsburgh being no longer essential, I returned to New York and resumed experimental work in a laboratory on Grand Street, where I began immediately the design of high-frequency machines. The problems of construction in this unexplored field were novel and quite peculiar, and I encountered many difficulties. I rejected the inductor type, fearing that it might not yield perfect sine waves, which were so important to resonant action. Had it not been for this, I could have saved myself a great deal of labor. Another discouraging factor of the high-frequency alternator seemed to be the inconstancy of speed, which threatened to impose serious limitations to its use. I had already noted in my demonstrations before the American Institution of Electrical Engineers that several times the tune was lost, necessitating readjustment, and did not yet foresee what I discovered long afterwards, a means of operating a machine of this kind at a speed constant to such a degree as not to vary more than a small fraction of one revolution between the extremes of load. The invention of the Tesla coil. From many other considerations, it appeared desirable to invent a simpler device for the production of electric oscillations. In 1856, Lord Kelvin had exposed the theory of the condenser discharge, but no practical application of that important knowledge was made. I saw the possibilities and undertook the development of induction apparatus on this principle. My progress was so rapid as to enable me to exhibit at my lecture in 1891 a coil giving sparks of 5 inches. On that occasion, I frankly told the engineers of a defect involved in the transformation by the new method, namely the loss in the spark gap. Subsequent investigation showed that no matter what medium is employed, be it air, hydrogen, mercury vapor, oil, or a stream of electrons, the efficiency is the same. It is a law very much like that governing the conversion of mechanical energy. We may drop a weight from a certain height vertically down or carry it to the lower level along any devious path. It is immaterial insofar as the amount of work is concerned. Fortunately, however, this drawback is not fatal, as by proper proportioning of the resonant circuits an efficiency of 85% is attainable. Since my early announcement of the invention, it has come into universal use and wrought a revolution in many departments. But a still greater future awaits it. When in 1900 I obtained powerful discharges of 100 feet and flashed a current around the globe, I was reminded of the first tiny spark I observed in my Grand Street laboratory, and was thrilled by sensations akin to those I felt when I discovered the rotating magnetic field. End of section 4. Section 5 of My Inventions and Other Works of Nikola Tesla, Electrical Experimenter, February to October 1919. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Avai in December 2018. My Inventions, Part 5.
Section 1. Of My Inventions and Other Works, The Autobiography of Nikola Tesla, Electrical Experimenter, February to October 1919. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Kane Mercer. My Inventions, Part 1, My Early Life, by Nikola Tesla. This article was published in Electrical Experimenter, February 1919. How does the world's greatest inventor invent? How does he carry out an invention? What sort of mentality has Nikola Tesla? Was his early life as commonplace as most of ours? What was the early training of one of the world's chosen? These and many other very interesting questions are answered in an incomparable manner by Nikola Tesla himself in this, his first article. In his autobiography, treating mainly on his early youth, we obtain a good insight into the wonderful life this man has led. It reads like a fairy tale, which has the advantage of being true, for Tesla is no common mortal. He has led a charmed life, struck down by the pest, the cholera, and whatnot, given up by doctors at least 3 times as dead. We find him at 60, younger than ever. But, read his own words, you have never read the like before. Editor. The progressive development of man is vitally dependent on invention. It is the most important product of his creative brain. Its ultimate purpose is the complete mastery of mind over the material world, the harnessing of the forces of nature to human needs. This is the difficult task of the inventor who is often misunderstood and unrewarded.
But he finds ample compensation in the pleasing exercises of his powers, and in the knowledge of being one of that exceptionally privileged class without whom the race would have long ago perished in the bitter struggle against pitiless elements.
Speaking for myself, I have already had more than my full measure of this exquisite enjoyment, so much that for many years my life was little short of continuous rapture. I am credited with being one of the hardest workers, and perhaps I am, if thought is the equivalent of labor, for I have devoted to it almost all of my waking hours. But if work is interpreted to be a definite performance in a specified time according to a rigid rule, then I may be the worst of idlers. Every effort under compulsion demands a sacrifice of life energy. I never paid such a price. On the contrary, I have thrived on my thoughts. In attempting to give a connected and faithful account of my activities in this series of articles, which will be presented with the assistance of the editors of the Electrical Experimenter and are chiefly addressed to our young men readers, I must dwell, however reluctantly, on the impressions of my youth and the circumstances and events which have been instrumental in determining my career. Our first endeavors are purely instinctive, promptings of an imagination vivid and undisciplined. As we grow older, reason asserts itself and we become more and more systematic and designing. But those early impulses, though not immediately productive, are of the greatest moment and may shape our very destinies. Indeed, I feel now that had I understood and cultivated instead of suppressing them, I would have added substantial value to my bequest to the world. But not until I had attained manhood did I realize that I was an inventor. This was due to a number of causes. In the first place, I had a brother who was gifted to an extraordinary degree, one of those rare phenomena of mentality which biological investigation has failed to explain.
His premature death left my parents disconsolate.
We owned a horse, which had been presented to us by a dear friend. It was a magnificent animal of Arabian breed, possessed of almost human intelligence, and was cared for and petted by the whole family, having on one occasion saved my father's life under remarkable circumstances.
My father had been called one winter night to perform an urgent duty, and while crossing the mountains infested by wolves, the horse became frightened and ran away, throwing him violently to the ground. It arrived home bleeding and exhausted, but after the alarm was sounded, immediately dashed off again, returning to the spot, and before the searching party were far on the way, they were met by my father, who had recovered consciousness and remounted, not realizing that he had been lying in the snow for several hours.
This horse was responsible for my brother's injuries, from which he died. I witnessed the tragic scene, and although 56 years have elapsed since, my visual impression of it has lost none of its force. The recollection of his attainments made every effort of mine seem dull in comparison. Anything I did that was creditable merely caused my parents to feel their loss more keenly. So I grew up with little confidence in myself.
But I was far from being considered a stupid boy, if I am to judge from an incident of which I have still a strong remembrance.
One day, the aldermen were passing through a street where I was at play with the other boys. The oldest of these venerable gentlemen, a wealthy citizen, paused to give a silver piece to each of us. Coming to me, he suddenly stopped and commanded, "Look in my eyes." I met his gaze, my hand outstretched to receive the much-valued coin, when to my dismay he said, "No, not much. You can get nothing from me. You are too smart." They used to tell a funny story about me. I had two old aunts with wrinkled faces, one of them having two teeth protruding like tusks of an elephant, which she buried in my cheek every time she kissed me. Nothing would scare me more than the prospect of being hugged by these affectionate as unattractive relatives. It happened that while being carried in my mother's arms, they asked me who was the prettier of the two. After examining their faces intently, I answered thoughtfully, pointing to one of them, "This here is not as ugly as the other." Then again, I was intended from my very birth for the clerical profession, and this thought constantly oppressed me. I longed to be an engineer, but my father was inflexible. He was the son of an officer who served in the army of the great Napoleon, and, in common with his brother, professor of mathematics in a prominent institution, had received a military education, but, singularly enough, later embraced the clergy, in which vocation he achieved eminence.
He was a very erudite man, a veritable natural philosopher, poet, and writer, and his sermons were said to be as eloquent as those of Abraham Santa Clara.
He had a prodigious memory, and frequently recited at length from works in several languages. He often remarked playfully that if some of the classics were lost, he could restore them. His style of writing was much admired. He penned sentences short and terse, and was full of wit and satire. The humorous remarks he made were always peculiar and characteristic. Just to illustrate, I may mention one or two instances. Among the help, there was a cross-eyed man called Maine, employed to do work around the farm. He was chopping wood one day. As he swung the axe, my father, who stood nearby and felt very uncomfortable, cautioned him. "For God's sake, Maine, do not strike at what you are looking, but at what you intend to hit." On another occasion, he was taking out for a drive a friend who carelessly permitted his costly fur coat to rub on the carriage wheel. My father reminded him of it, saying, "Pull in your coat, you are ruining my tire."
He had the odd habit of talking to himself and would often carry on an animated conversation and indulge in heated argument, changing the tone of his voice. A casual listener might have sworn that several people were in the same room. Although I must trace to my mother's influence whatever inventiveness I possess, the training he gave me must have been helpful. It comprised all sorts of exercises, as guessing one another's thoughts, discovering the defects of some form or expression, repeating long sentences, or performing mental calculations.
These daily lessons were intended to strengthen memory and reason and especially to develop the critical sense, and were undoubtedly very beneficial. My mother descended from one of the oldest families in the country and a line of inventors.
Both her father and grandfather originated numerous implements for household, agricultural, and other uses.
She was a truly great woman of rare skill, courage, and fortitude, who had braved the storms of life and passed through many a trying experience. When she was 16, a virulent pestilence swept the country. Her father was called away to administer the last sacraments to the dying, and during his absence, she went alone to the assistance of a neighboring family who were stricken by the dread disease. All of the members, five in number, succumbed in rapid succession.
She bathed, clothed, and laid out the bodies, decorating them with flowers according to the custom of the country, and when her father returned, he found everything ready for a Christian burial. My mother was an inventor of the first order, and would, I believe, have achieved great things had she not been so remote from modern life and its multifold opportunities.
She invented and constructed all kinds of tools and devices, and wove the finest designs from thread which was spun by her. She even planted the seeds, raised the plants, and separated the fibers herself. She worked indefatigably from break of day till late at night, and most of the wearing apparel and furnishings of the home was the product of her hands. When she was past 60, her fingers were still nimble enough to tie 3 knots in an eyelash.
There was another and still more important reason for my late awakening. In my boyhood, I suffered from a peculiar affliction due to the appearance of images, often accompanied by strong flashes of light, which marred the sight of real objects and interfered with my thought and action.
They were pictures of things and scenes which I had already seen, never of those I imagined. When a word was spoken to me, the image of the object it designated would present itself vividly to my vision, and sometimes I was quite unable to distinguish whether what I saw was tangible or not. This caused me great discomfort and anxiety. None of the students of psychology or physiology whom I have consulted could ever explain satisfactorily these phenomena. They seem to have been unique, although I was probably predisposed, as I know my brother experienced a similar trouble. The theory I have formulated is that the images were the result of a reflex action from the brain on the retina under great excitation.
They certainly were not hallucinations such as are produced in diseased and anguished minds, for in other respects I was normal and composed. To give an idea of my distress, suppose that I had witnessed a funeral or some such nerve-wracking spectacle.
Then, inevitably, in the stillness of night, a vivid picture of the scene would thrust itself before my eyes and persist despite all my efforts to banish it. Sometimes it would even remain fixed in space, though I pushed my hand through it.
If my explanation is correct, it should be able to project on a screen the image of any object one conceives and make it visible. Such an advance would revolutionize all human relations. I'm convinced that this wonder can and will be accomplished in time to come.
I may add that I have devoted much thought to the solution of the problem. To free myself of these tormenting appearances, I tried to concentrate my mind on something else I had seen, and in this way I would often obtain temporary relief, but in order to get it, I had to conjure continuously new images.
It was not long before I found that I had exhausted all of those at my command. My reel had run out, as it were, because I had seen little of the world, only objects in my home and the immediate surroundings.
As I performed these mental operations for the second or third time, in order to chase the appearances from my vision, the remedy gradually lost all its force. Then I instinctively commenced to make excursions beyond the limits of the small world of which I had knowledge, and I saw new scenes. These were at first very blurred and indistinct, and would flit away when I tried to concentrate my attention upon them, but by and by I succeeded in fixing them. They gained in strength and distinctness, and finally assumed the correctness of real things. I soon discovered that my best comfort was attained if I simply went on in my vision farther and farther, getting new impressions all the time. And so I began to travel, of course, in my mind. Every night, and sometimes during the day, when alone, I would start on my journeys, see new places, cities and countries, live there, meet people and make friendships and acquaintances, and, however unbelievable, it is a fact that they were just as dear to me as those in actual life, and not a bit less intense in their manifestations. This I did constantly until I was about 17, when my thoughts turned seriously to invention.
Then I observed to my delight that I could visualize with the greatest facility. I needed no models, drawings, or experiments. I could picture them all as real in my mind.
Thus I have been led unconsciously to evolve what I consider a new method of materializing inventive concepts and ideas, which is radically opposite to the purely experimental and is, in my opinion, ever so much more expeditious and efficient. The moment one constructs a device to carry into practice a crude idea, he finds himself unavoidably engrossed with the details and defects of the apparatus.
As he goes on improving and reconstructing, his force of concentration diminishes and he loses sight of the great underlying principle. Results may be obtained, but always at the sacrifice of quality.
My method is different. I do not rush into actual work. When I get an idea, I start at once building it up in my imagination. I change the construction, make improvements, and operate the device in my mind. It is absolutely immaterial to me whether I run my turbine in thought or test it in my shop. I even note if it is out of balance. There is no difference whatsoever. The results are the same. In this way, I am able to rapidly develop and perfect a conception without touching anything. When I have gone so far as to embody in the invention every possible improvement I can think of and see no fault anywhere, I put into concrete form this final product of my brain. Invariably, my device works as I conceive that it should, and the experiment comes out exactly as I planned it. In 20 years, there has not been a single exception. Why should it be otherwise? Engineering, electrical and mechanical, is positive in results. There is scarcely a subject that cannot be mathematically treated and the effects calculated or the results determined beforehand from the available theoretical and practical data. The carrying out into practice of a crude idea, as is being generally done, is, I hold, nothing but a waste of energy, money, and time. My early affliction had, however, another compensation. The incessant mental exertion developed my powers of observation and enabled me to discover a truth of great importance.
I had noted that the appearance of images was always preceded by the actual vision of scenes under peculiar and generally very exceptional conditions, and I was impelled on each occasion to locate the original impulse. After a while, this effort grew to be almost automatic, and I gained great facility in connecting cause and effect.
Soon I became aware, to my surprise, that every thought I conceived was suggested by an external impression. Not only this, but all my actions were prompted in a similar way. In the course of time, it became perfectly evident to me that I was merely an automaton, endowed with power of movement, responding to the stimuli of the sense organs and thinking and acting accordingly.
The practical result of this was the art of teleautomatics, which has been so far carried out only in an imperfect manner. Its latent possibilities will, however, be eventually shown. I have been since years planning self-controlled automata and believe that mechanisms can be produced which will act as if possessed of reason to a limited degree and will create a revolution in many commercial and industrial departments. I was about 12 years old when I first succeeded in banishing an image from my vision by willful effort, but I never had any control over the flashes of light to which I have referred.
They were, perhaps, my strangest experience, and inexplicable. They usually occurred when I found myself in a dangerous or distressing situation, or when I was greatly exhilarated. In some instances, I have seen all the air around me filled with tongues of living flame. Their intensity, instead of diminishing, increased with time and seemingly attained a maximum when I was about 25 years old. While in Paris, in 1883, a prominent French manufacturer sent me an invitation to a shooting expedition, which I accepted. I had been long confined to the factory, and the fresh air had a wonderfully invigorating effect on me. On my return to the city that night, I felt a positive sensation that my brain had caught fire. I saw a light as though a small sun was located in it, and I passed the whole night applying cold compressions to my tortured head. Finally, the flashes diminished in frequency and force, but it took me more than 3 weeks before they wholly subsided. When a second invitation was extended to me, my answer was an emphatic no. These luminous phenomena still manifest themselves from time to time, as when a new idea opening up possibilities strikes me. But they are no longer exciting, being of relatively small intensity. When I close my eyes, I invariably observe first a background of very dark and uniform blue, not unlike the sky on a clear but starless night.
In a few seconds, this field becomes animated with innumerable scintillating flakes of green, arranged in several layers and advancing towards me.
Then there appears, to the right, a beautiful pattern of two systems of parallel and closely spaced lines at right angles to one another, in all sorts of colors with yellow, green, and gold predominating. Immediately thereafter, the lines grow brighter, and the whole is thickly sprinkled with dots of twinkling light. This picture moves slowly across the field of vision, and in about 10 seconds vanishes to the left, leaving behind a ground of rather unpleasant and inert gray, which quickly gives way to a billowy sea of clouds, seemingly trying to mold themselves in living shapes. It is curious that I cannot project a form into this gray until the second phase is reached. Every time before falling asleep, images of persons or objects flit before my view. When I see them, I know that I am about to lose consciousness. If they are absent and refuse to come, it means a sleepless night.
To what an extent imagination played a part in my early life, I may illustrate by another odd experience. Like most children, I was fond of jumping and developed an intense desire to support myself in the air.
Occasionally, a strong wind, richly charged with oxygen, blew from the mountains, rendering my body as light as a cork, and then I would leap and float in space for a long time. It was a delightful sensation, and my disappointment was keen when later I undeceived myself. During that period, I contracted many strange likes, dislikes, and habits, some of which I can trace to external impressions, while others are unaccountable. I had a violent aversion against the earrings of women, but other ornaments, as bracelets, pleased me more or less according to design. The sight of a pearl would almost give me a fit, but I was fascinated with the glitter of crystals or objects with sharp edges and plain surfaces.
I would not touch the hair of other people except, perhaps, at the point of a revolver. I would get a fever by looking at a peach, and if a piece of camphor was anywhere in the house, it caused me the keenest discomfort.
Even now, I'm not insensible to some of these upsetting impulses. When I drop little squares of paper in a dish filled with liquid, I always sense a peculiar and awful taste in my mouth. I counted the steps in my walks and calculated the cubical